All right, you ready? Okay. We are gathered here tonight to begin a little series, hopefully at least two, maybe even three, talking about artificial intelligence and halakha. A good question. We're going to obviously have to describe what artificial intelligence is.
It's not fearful.
Okay, so hold on one second, and let me pause the recorder so we don't have to waste our time. All right. This is the topic of artificial intelligence and halakha. It's not an easy topic to research. I found some stuff online, used my own imagination, built a little bit of myself. YU has some resources, but they're kind of fluffy. Some of them are a little bit better than others. And what we'll do tonight is we'll definitely go over, I guess what you would call, I mean, it's hard to call it the secular side, the science part. the science side of things, just to describe what we're going to be dealing with here, what kind of artificial intelligence we're going to be talking about. And we'll do at least the beginning of the halakha portion, but I'll describe to you all of the halakha that we're going to talk about. But I'd love to hear from you guys ideas about other issues that might come up. So first, we're going to define artificial intelligence. That's a not easy thing to do. And the truth is, I'm not even going to go as far back as, you know, the beginning of the days when they started to talk about. I'm really only going to go back maximum 22 years, all right? And we're really going to see this through what seems like a little bit of a myopic lens at the beginning, but it's really the best way to look at it, which is games. Really the best way to look at the history of artificial intelligence is its development through essentially video games. But it's not just video, it's like classic games, like chess. You know, chess is the first one that we're going to look at, but obviously when you play chess with a computer, that's going to be a video game, just what it's going to be called. And that's where we're going to start. There are three, you could break down the history of artificial intelligence in many, many different ways. This is just the way that I think of it, and I think it's it makes sense, and it will help us to see the development. So the first point where artificial intelligence really started to take off was actually in 1997. That's when people started to really take it seriously, because that was the year that Deep Blue, which was a supercomputer, it had, by the way, it had precursors to it, deep this, deep that, they like to do deep. So Deep Blue, and actually it had a previous iteration of Deep Blue a year beforehand, that had a chess match with Garry Kasparov, then the grandmaster of the world. Mm-hmm. Because Bobby Fischer disappeared, and he's Russian, I believe, Kasparov.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Who, Bobby Fischer? Or Fischer, right. Kasparov played against a supercomputer and beat it 4-2, which means he lost twice, which is a big deal. But then, the next year, in 1997, Deep Blue beat him soundly, handily, ripped him apart. He was kind of bitter about it. He basically said that he thought the second match, he thought there was cheating involved. He thought that there was a human interaction. He felt there was deep intelligence on the other side. He felt like there was another person there. There wasn't. He said afterwards he didn't believe in artificial intelligence. He felt like he was beaten. He said, you know, it's not any more glamorous, but I was pretty much beaten by a $10 million alarm clock. That's what he felt like. Which is, you know, what it seemed like. So what I have over here is from Wikipedia, their description of it. And it will help us understand and differentiate the technology that was used to beat Kasparov, Deep Blue, from other iterations of artificial intelligence. So here, this is specific to chess. And it says, Deep Blue's evaluation functions was initially written in a generalized form with many to be determined parameters. For example, how important is a safe king position compared to a space advantage to the center, etc. The optimal values for these parameters were then determined by the system itself by analyzing thousands of master games. This is key. How did Deep Blue work? It had a huge database, huge memory base, bank of basically all the games that had been played in history. All the major games that had been played in history that had been recorded, it had in its memory bank. So it basically knew in any position that you find yourself, what's the best next move that you could take? How does it know? Because it already knows the history. Okay?
Which means it wasn't thinking for itself.
No, it was purely brute force. And not only is it brute force, it's all programmed in beforehand.
There's no chidush
at all. It's all programmed in beforehand. A human being inputted into this computer everything that is in the computer. A computer has nothing that a human being didn't put into it. It just is able to very, very, very quickly analyze the board and decide what the next move it should be based on history, based on what the outcome is likely to be.
But isn't that what a human does as well?
Maybe not.
Well, as a human can do a move outside of his head. Never done
it. It's definitely not the only thing that a human could do. I mean, for example, if you take a child and you teach a child the rules of chess, he knows how to play chess. He's not doing it based on previous moves that he knew. He's just doing whatever makes sense to him, whatever that is.
A human with an amazing memory could probably do what his computer.
Well, that's what Gary.
No, probably not.
Well, that's
amazing memory. No, that's Kasparov. Right, you're right. Kasparov has rules. Yeah, you're right. You're right. But of course, in any given situation, there are multiple options. The difference between Kasparov and the computer is that the computer has already worked out everything. You know, if he does this, then I'm going to do that. If he does this, I'm going to do that. Yeah, but he can't do it at the same level the computer can.
Right. Their memory is like a
yes,
thing.
But it's not the same as a computer.
See
this is the point, though. This is the point. The point over here is that they proved. Since he was beaten by a computer, the computer does it better than he does. If that's the way that he's doing it, the computer can do it better than he does. Since then, you know, basically it was the game is up. You know, you can't beat a supercomputer at chess. The only thing that could possibly beat a supercomputer at chess is another supercomputer. So we'll get there later. So that was 1997. Now again, I want to say that over there, the computer, I don't think we would consider it smart. Because, like I said before, you know, and when I was learning computers, by the way, when I was learning computer science, so the teacher emphasized over and over, there's nothing smart about computers because it only does what you tell it to do. It does what you tell it to do. There's nothing smart about it. It's not intelligent. Whatever you program the computer to do, that's what it's going to do. You give it commands, it carries out the commands. It seems smart, but it's not. And that was true in 1997. Jump forward to 2011. And what happened in 2011? So there's a game in America, it's called Jeopardy. Okay, Jeopardy is one of those.
I saw those shows.
Yeah, I did too. I remember. Well, I guess I was in Israel, but I do remember seeing it on the news. Yeah.
By the way, if you remember Milky Bloom from our shul,
yeah,
his son was one of the designers of that.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. He was in the audience and he was ecstatic when he won.
So what happened is this: Jeopardy is a game in America. It's a trivia game, where you have to, you know, basically there's an answer. It's quote unquote an answer. Like it could be, you know, he starred in the first Batman movie alongside Jack Nicholson. Okay, so then you're supposed to say who was Michael Keaton, right? You're supposed to say something like that, right? Which is ridiculous because the answer to who is Michael Keaton is not he starred, you know, in the first Batman movie. But that's the way the game works.
But the jeopardy is that if you answer the wrong,
right. If you answer wrong, then you lose the amount of money that you bet. Right. There is also double jeopardy, all different kinds of things. Strategy in the game, but of course you have to be able to know the answer. There was a guy named Ken Jennings who was the most winningest Jeopardy player ever. It was 70-something games in a row, which is still the record. No, I think the guy made more money but didn't win more games than Ken Jennings.
Right.
So he won the most games. So in 2011, Ken Jennings and another guy, who nobody remembers his name, basically went up against this IBM Watson computer. And IBM Watson was a supercomputer. It was housed in IBM's like huge room computer, but all there was you know, was connected through the internet so that there would be just, you know, a stand there with no person there, an interface. And they played a game. And it says, like, basically the game, that Watson was a little bit shaky, but then by the end he blew them all away. He beat both of the former champions handily. Now, if you researched
it, like 28,000-1.
Yeah, he won a lot, and they were better than Kasparov about it. Ken Jennings apparently wrote in his final Jeopardy, he wrote the right answer, and then he wrote, "And I happily welcome our new computer overlords." Who are going to take over the world, right? So they were good-natured about it. Now, if you look in Wikipedia, so it explains how it works. It says, as opposed to other AIs, artificial intelligence, such as IBM's Deep Blue or Watson, which were developed for a predefined purpose and only function with the... Oh, I'm reading the wrong one. I'm reading DeepMind, sorry. Watson parts his questions into different keywords and sentence fragments in order to find statistically related phrases. Watson's main innovation was not in the creation of a new algorithm for this operation, but rather its ability to quickly execute hundreds of proven language analysis algorithms simultaneously. The more algorithms that find the same answer independently, the more likely Watson is to be correct. Once Watson has a small number of potential solutions, it's able to check against the database to ascertain whether the solution makes sense or not. Okay, so in sum, basically what happens is this. Watson has a huge database of information. He wasn't actually connected to the internet for its information. He has a defined database, just like a human being would. He's not able to get more information. He has all the information that he has it right in front of him. He parses the sentence so that he can understand a little bit of what the answer question is. But he doesn't really understand it. What he does know how to do is he knows how to reach out into basically his search engine and put together phrases that he already knows and see if they fit together with the answer. And then he develops a probability that he has the right answer. Okay, so he has an algorithm that tells him how he can figure out, is what I'm saying probably right or not? If it's probably right, I think the threshold, I don't know what the threshold was. It was like some percentage, like 70%, 80%. Then he bets, he guesses. If it's not, he doesn't.
I think what he did was he came up with three answers.
Yeah.
And he
on the screen, they showed you the three answers.
On the screen, that's right.
On the screen, yeah. On the screen, they showed you the three answers and the probability of each one. Now, the thing was, when he got it right, he was faster than everybody else. When he got it wrong, his answer was ridiculous. It made no sense. It was just stupid. Now, what you would get from that is that, of course, Watson didn't know the answer in the same way that we know the answers to questions. Like, I know Michael Keaton starred in the first Batman movie against Jack Nicholson, who played the Joker, because I saw the movie. I know who Michael Keaton is. I know who Jack Nicholson is. I know who these people are, so I know the answer. In a really, really deep way. Whereas Watson, all he knows how to do is he knows how to guess the answer based on the algorithms that he's provided with. Now, I don't think you can say he's dumb in the same way that Deep Blue is dumb. Deep Blue, he just knows, he's memorized everything, right? He's memorized the tables and he knows what to do in every situation. Watson has algorithms. He's got methods of figuring things out, which humans have as well, right? It's actually hard to distinguish between the way that I know and the way that he knows. You have to really, you have to trust me philosophically that there's a difference. Because Watson, he has a way of parsing the question and then finding the answer. Is that smart? Is it not smart? It's definitely not the same as what I do, but it's definitely a measure of intelligence, and human beings do that. We have algorithms. That's how we figure out things as well. So that's an evolution to the next step. The final evolution that I'm aware of right now is what's called machine learning. There are different kinds of machine, deep learning, machine learning, reinforcement learning. They're pretty much all variations of the same thing, and it's typified by the new supercomputer, the newest one that is, I guess, reigning champion, called DeepMind. That's another IBM computer, actually not IBM, actually it's owned by Google now. And the reason why we think it's so smart is because DeepMind beat Deep Blue. It didn't just beat Deep Blue. He beat all the new iterations of Deep Blue. Everything else that worked the same way. Now, how is DeepMind different from Deep Blue? DeepMind does something called machine learning. What is machine learning? Machine learning is basically to learn the same way that humans learn. What they would do is you give the computer. Let's say you pick an area. Pick chess. You say, okay, computer, this is how chess works. Same way you would teach a child. The king can move this way. The queen can move that way. The horse can move that way, and all those kinds of things. And then DeepMind goes into its own memory, and it plays millions of games of chess against itself until it figures out the best strategies. And it knows what to do, not because it memorized anything, but because it's figured it out by itself. Which means nobody told the computer that the best thing to do when you're facing the following configuration on the board is X or Y. It figured it out itself. That computer beats Deep Blue, beats the other version. Now, that's where we are now. Now, why does all this matter? We're not playing chess. We're not playing... by the way, AlphaGo is another one. Go was the latest big thing. Go is a Korean or Japanese? Korean? Yeah. It has
iterations of it, multiple.
Yeah, much more than chess. Options are much more than chess. And AlphaGo just beat the reigning Go champion. So they've beat them at that too. None of us have played Go, but apparently it's very impressive. It's a game. It's a game. Now, why does it matter? So I put on over here some of the other achievements. In 2016, DeepMind turned its artificial intelligence to protein folding, one of the toughest problems in science. In 2018, AlphaFold won the 13th critical assessment of techniques for protein structure prediction by successfully predicting the most accurate structure for 25 out of 43 proteins. In other words, they used it for science. And it did it. It did it better than anybody else ever did. Google stated that DeepMind algorithms have greatly increased the efficiency of cooling its data centers. In other words, they took a practical problem that you would usually have human engineers work on, and human engineers would use their minds, brilliant people, Google engineers would use their mind to try to figure something out, and instead they told, "Here, computer, here's the problem, here's the physics of it, figure it out."
They still have to give it all the data it needs.
Yeah, of course, you have to give it the data, but it builds its own models. It tries out its own simulations, and it does it, you know, it doesn't sleep, and it performs at tremendous speed.
You still need to provide a basis for it to work when you go into
cycles. You'd have to teach it the rules. Once you teach it the rules, it figures it out. You give it a goal, and that's it. Just like you would for a human. If I said, here's my problem. I want you to go out there and make me some money.
Yeah.
On the stock market. Here's how the stock market. You'd have to know how the stock market works in order to do it, right?
There is a lot of guiding that still needs to be done. A human involvement at this point is still required.
It depends what you want the computer to do. No more guidance than you would have to give a human being. If you said, human, here's what I want you to do, you give it the same amount of information, and then you say, go figure it out. That's it.
From my understanding, it's not as simple as that. It's a lot more complicated than that.
I mean, it's definitely more complicated than that. But in terms of the philosophy of how it works and how it does work,
that's the goal.
It was working like this.
It probably took them a long time for them to.
The challenge is how to give the computer the information. Of course, that's the challenge.
And it needs guidance.
Right.
It needs guidance, strong guidance, initially.
Initially, yes. Now, here's the question, though. Have we reached, if this is the way it's working, have we reached real intelligence? Because essentially, viewed simplistically, I'm giving the computer a problem, and I'm saying, here are the rules, like you would have to do in any situation, go solve the problem. And the computer solves the problem without any more of my input. I don't tell it what it should or should not do in terms of efficiency. It figures out the most efficient way. I'll tell you how deep this goes, right? We're going to talk about it later, hopefully. But let's say machine learning with self-driving cars. It's one of the cases where machine learning really is being used a lot. Let's say there's an accident. We'll talk about the ramifications halakhically of an accident. Computer scientists have acknowledged that at this point, if a Tesla automobile is on the road and it gets into an accident, programmers, the ones who program the car, will have no explanation for why the car did what it did. Because they didn't tell the car to do that. The car told itself to do that. All they did was tell the car, here are the rules of the road. They will not.
For instance, one of the early crashes, there was like a trailer, it was too high, and the sensors didn't see it. So that was a mistaken sentence. So they saw the reason.
You may be able to tell.
It was a gap in its knowledge. It was a gap in its knowledge, which meant it didn't know how to deal with the situation.
It could be that early on they were able to do that. As it gets more and more complicated, they won't be able to.
At the moment, they're
not at that point yet.
This is what Tesla themselves are saying.
Yeah, but the years, every crash they've had, they can still pinpoint. They know why it meant. It's just there's a gap in its knowledge. Something came out new that it didn't know how to react to.
But now it does, I assume, right?
It does if the computer taught itself. Not because humans do.
But it teaches itself through experience.
It does. The point is, speaking as a computer programmer, if I want to analyze a bug, right? We have a problem in production, the server is doing something weird. What do? I look in the code, I had to debug the code, I find the problematic line.
It's not
where it's happening, and then I can fix it.
This is different. So
it's very different.
Instead of being a problem in the code, but you can still see the gap in its knowledge, which is what caused it to make the mistake.
That may be the case, but the point over here is though there's no longer a line of code that I can change and fix it. I can't.
As a driver, I do the same thing.
But you can change your experience.
Of course. The computer will learn from the experience that if you tell it, you know, that was wrong, what you just did.
Right. So you know
that was not good. You have to tell it that.
So as opposed to being a problem in the code, there's a problem in its experience, like
right.
a human.
But this is that's a much more complicated problem. I'm telling you that if the problem is only, okay, there's a problematic line in the code, I can, first of all, I can fix the line of code, and I can write tests so that it doesn't happen again. That's what I do. That's what I do for a living. With machine learning, that's not an option anymore because the computer is writing its own code, and it is code. It's writing its own code. There are literally not even just in the field of self-driving cars, but the field of computers writing computer code is a growing field. Now, how do you debug? You can't debug that because you didn't write the code. So you don't know how it works. Because computers don't write code the same way humans do. It doesn't look the same. We try to make things human-readable. Computers don't bother. So that's one of the things that makes it much more complicated and a little bit scary. Now, okay, so what does this mean for us? So what I would like to do, I thought of at least three areas of what I call practical application in halakha. In Torah, for artificial intelligence. Not just halakha, in Torah in general. The first one, which I will talk about tonight, is what I called the psak machine, which is to talk about whether or not we can actually use artificial intelligence for creating halakha, for creating Torah, and what the ramifications of that might be. The second is to talk about the classic case that came up already and that always comes up in these conversations, which is damages and liability issues. When a computer or a robot does something, and I own the robot, let's say, or I program the robot, who's liable? Right? So in the case of the self-driving cars, so if the car does something it shouldn't have done and killed somebody or caused damage, and it's clear that it was a mistake, right? Or even if it wasn't clear that it was a mistake, so there are three options. One option is that the owner is liable. The other option is that the company is liable. And the third option is that nobody's liable. Those are three options, right? We have to figure out which one of those is correct. By the way, I want to take it one more step. What happens if it wasn't a self-driving car, which is, you know, relatively benign? What if I program a robot to rob banks for me? Now, generally speaking, if I pay David to go rob a bank for me, and he does it, who's liable, Api Alacha? David. Not me.
Not
Api Beit Din Shalmata. I don't pay a cent. He should have known better. I'm not saying that I won't be prosecuted in a court of law, but I'll be baitin, I'm not chayav. Is a robot similar to that? And if it's not, let's say it's not. If I develop a machine that I'll be grama causes damage to my neighbor's property, am I liable? General, grama benazikin is pater. Grama is indirect causative action. What if I develop a robot to go into my neighbor's yard and start ripping up the yard? Is that grama? Do we talk about Asia? There are all kinds of subjects that can come up. Okay? And the third area that I wanted to talk about, is the extension of the robot question, is there ever a point where the artificial intelligence becomes intelligence and we treat it as effectively human? And maybe even Jewish. Well, could you if you developed an artificial intelligence, could you use it for a minion? Can you kill such a robot? You laugh, but you'll see how interesting it gets and why it's not insane. Can you kill such a robot?
It's certainly more insane.
Let's
than
take
not
it.
Having your toast ready.
Yeah. This is not really artificial intelligence, but definitely interesting for you to think about because it's just a step removed on the future scale, which is when somebody you know, inevitably figures out a way to, I'm going to fudge the words here, but to transfer consciousness to a computer, to the cloud, so to speak, and then a robot comes out, and we call that robot Yoel, because it does everything that Yoel would do and has all the memories that Yoel has, then how do we view that? And that's not artificial intelligence per se, because it's supposedly Yoel intelligence. But how do we view that? Is that possible? Do we view that as, you know, that is Yoel? Or is it something else? These are all important questions. So those are the three areas that I wanted to talk about. But we'll start tonight with the first, which is in the area of Talmud Torah itself. So I guess presciently, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, this is the first thing that I looked for, because I just remembered the phrase that he used. This is an essay that he wrote in 1998. So he writes, illustrations apart, however, the cogency and legitimacy of a human approach to psak appears to many problematic. The context over here is he's actually talking about the idea that some people think that a posek shouldn't be inserting his own human biases into psak. It should just be black and white, yes, no, mathematical, calculated answer. He says some people think that. They would have us believe that the ideal posek is a faceless and heartless supercomputer into whom all of the relevant data is fed and who then produces the right answer. Right? This is a year after Deep Blue. Should this standard not be met, the shortfall is to be regarded as a failing. The lamentable results of human frailty, in Bacon's terms, a manifestation of the besetting idols which hamper and hinder the capacity for reasoned judgment. On this reading, the process of psika, of coming up with a psak, properly conceived and executed, bears no semblance to an existential encounter between seeker and respondent, the person asking the question and the answerer. In other words, there's no human relationship. It entails rather the application of text to problem, the coupling of code and situation. When he says code here, he doesn't mean computer code. He means like the Shulchan Aruch. This conception does not necessarily preclude reckoning with the specific circumstances of the question and questioner, as these may very well be part of the relevant objective data. He says, and don't tell me that, okay, no, of course there's human involved because that's part of the data. You're right. It's always the person asking the question, that person viewed as a person, is always going to be part of the psika. But how do you approach that? Do you approach that with cold reasoning or with humanity? The prevailing tendency, however, would be to dwarf this factor. And as to the human aspect of the meshiv, that would be obviated entirely. The person answering the question, he should be a computer. Even if the person sitting in front of you remains a human, the person answering the question, he should be able to shed all emotion and just view things objectively. That's what you would have us believe. He, for his part, is to be animated by the precept that we do not have mercy in judgment, and hence the pass on merits of the issue with imperviously stony objectivity. Now he says, in reality, however, this portrait of a posek is mere caricature, limbed by those who at most karu v'shanu, but certainly lo shimshu. Essentially what he's going to say is that anybody who's ever had experience with a great posek knows that the more human the person is, the better their psika is, the more insightful they are. They approach psak doubly animated by responsibility to halacha and sensitivity to human concerns. If you look, he quotes Rav Chaim of Elazhin in the blocked part. He says, and I saw that in most matters we were of like mind, except for the fact that his honor leans towards stringency, since the matter does not depend on him. Right, so Rav Chaim of Elazhin, who was a shul rabbi as well, he was a community rabbi, so he's writing to somebody and he's saying, you know, the difference between me and you is that you like to be machmir. And the reason you like to be machmir is because most people don't ask you questions. Likewise, before the yoke of practical decision was thrust upon me, I too did not incline toward the leniencies arising from legal analysis. He says, you know, when I was a yeshiva bacher, before I was actually a community rabbi, I also loved to just view things philosophically and come up with a black and white cold answer, and if that led to chumrah, then all the better, because then I found a new chumrah. In our great sins, however, the generation has been orphaned of sages, and now the yoke of practical halachic decision-making has been thrust upon me. For in our entire region, they do not free agunot in any manner without the concurrence of my meager opinion. Therefore, I have taken counsel with my maker, and feel obliged to gird all my strength and devote myself to remedying the situation of agunot. That's what they were talking about. And may the blessed Lord save me from error. In other words, I find the need to be makel with agunot, because I understand the human need, and I am human. Now you...
The people actually come to Rav Lichtenstein with...
Well, here's a frame of a legend. But
Rav Lichtenstein didn't himself wasn't a person who people came to him with was with questions of this.
Absolutely, they did. Of course, they did. Yeah, absolutely.
Is this kosher? Is this an aguna? Is this
aguna for sure?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he wrote.
Is this kosher? I don't know.
He wrote response on this.
Rav Lichtenstein did not write many tshuvas, or any at all, really. I mean, I'm sure he wrote some, but that wasn't his writing verve. But of course, guys, I mean, he was a Rosh Hashiva, right? He wasn't the community shul Rav.
Right.
His students would come to him. The state of Israel would come to him.
Yeah.
Are you saying that the inputs are only halachic, or are they emotional?
He's saying that there definitely are emotional inputs, not only on the level of understanding the person, but also on the level of the posik himself. He says, you would pask... What is he saying? He's saying, essentially, you would paskin differently on a shayla if you knew that they were going to listen to your answer than if you didn't know they were going to listen to your answer. Two people talking about a psak in a closed room, talking about a halachic situation, a technical halachic question, on a theoretical level, will come to different conclusions than a person who's actually practically being asked right now. And the Rav Lichtenstein says, and that's right, that's correct, that's the way it should be. Now, why should, in theory, there should be no difference. We should be figuring out what the objective truth is. But he's saying that the proper way of psika is to feel that pressure, and it should affect your halachic decision making.
Right, but isn't he also saying that in the calculation, those are part of the calculation that you should consider? That's what he's saying. So
yes.
It's possible that you could have halachic inputs, personal inputs, emotional inputs, and then the amalgam of all that. You still compute all that. He's just saying you have to go beyond the limited.
Yes, but if you were to take it back to our discussion, so Rav Lichtenstein would say, if a computer we're making the psak, there's no such thing as the computer feeling pressure, presumably. In other words, he doesn't feel pressure, he doesn't feel emotion, he doesn't feel pain or pleasure or compassion. You would insert compassion.
You could figure it out. I mean, in theory.
This is the question, right? What would you do? You would insert, okay, this is what human compassion looks like.
Yeah.
I mean,
it is. You could, in theory.
That's right now science fiction. It's not.
It's
that's
like
not
driving.
Really.
It's just like driving. There are certain rules which you can learn through experience.
But that's more about. It's almost always going to be about the second, the other side of the equation. In other words, the questioner. You're teaching the computer what the questioner is like. You're not teaching the computer how it should be like because.
No, because you give enough data points with questions and answers and all the relevant inputs, and it can figure out that there isn't where that there isn't.
So what Rav Lichtenstein I think is saying is that okay,
it's
look,
necessary.
You put
it's
in front of
to have the compassion, but isn't from all that I heard you saying is that you can't just say isn't like there's strict rules. I'll keep the code. However.
Okay, so you know what? Let's do this in a phased approach.
In
Let's do this as a phased approach, okay? We take the deep mind first,
deep mind,
right?
Sure.
Deep mind is basically saying, look, I know all of Shulchan Aruch, I know all of Shas, I know all of Poskim, I know everything everybody has ever written on Halacha. You come to me with this chicken, I can tell you what the Bach says, what the Shach says, and I can tell you what the consensus of the Poskim is. The Rav Lichtenstein says, that's all very good, that's perfect. The only problem is that you don't understand what it's like to be human. And so there's something missing. Well, that's a different issue. We'll get to that. That what he's saying is that you don't understand what it means to be human, so you can't really answer this question because you can't understand what the pressures are. Fine. Jump forward. I don't know if Watson helps us at all. But once you get to deep mind, then you start to get something. Once you get to deep mind, so you're saying, now you can put it into the computer. Okay, listen. You have to have compassion. Now, I don't know how you would.
You train. You give it.
You're not supposed to be training it, though.
No, but even like self-driving. So Tesla, it builds its self-driving capacity based on the real-world driving miles.
Yeah, I know.
That's the same thing. So with
objective, whereas emotions are subjective. Not only that, when you're communicating with somebody, information is gained not just through you can't put a facial expression.
Of course it is.
You definitely can.
All this information.
You definitely can.
The emotion generated from a facial expression.
You can from the other perspective.
Right, digitize that.
You can absolutely analyze what the other person is feeling. Absolutely, for sure. They're already there.
They're
already there. Yeah. What I'm more interested in is not what the other person is feeling. You're right. The computer can tell what the other person is feeling. But the computer doesn't feel anything. So you want to say, though, you can teach the computer to feel something.
You don't teach it to feel something. It can know how.
I don't know how, I don't know how you. What's the right way to do that? How do you?
No, first of all, as an oftentimes, autistic people, they don't feel. They feed off other people and to learn how to react in certain situations.
We're going to get back to this when we talk about what it means to be human. But I think what you're saying is correct in the sense that, you know, there are enough science fiction movies where robots don't even know that they're robots. You know, you have the Terminator movies, you have, actually it was called AI. Right? Steven Spielberg came out with that movie AI many years ago where it was a child. He didn't know he was a robot. That was what the whole plot was. A robot could not know that he's a robot, and then he learns to be human. That was you know, revolutionary, that idea. It's in many movies, but it learns to be.
2001.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we want that one.
What? It was Hal.
Yeah,
Hal learns to
kill Dave.
With somebody who's plotting to undo him, so he
kicked him out the airlock.
So the movie.
So that's what how he starts. Now we'll continue a little bit, and this is actually, if you keep going, look at this. He says, and does not the whole history of coping with Agunot reflect this concern? To anyone familiar with that history, the point is self-evident. And now he quotes the Masat Binyamin. Look at what he says. He's quoting another posik. In truth, I have written too expansively on this matter when I should have been brief. I did so because I know that the way of some of the sages is to follow the shining path and to avoid any doubt in the world unless they can determine a clear and unequivocal ruling, untinged by any contradictory considerations. They do this for the sake of heaven out of a fear of rendering halachic decisions. This is a good and straight path in all other areas of halachic decision-making, but regarding Agunot, that's not my position. Rather, I follow the well-trodden path who sought with all their strength all manner of considerations, primary and secondary, to be lenient in matters pertaining to Agunot, as I have cited above. Now, whence the sense that he should be lenient in Agunot? Where does that come from? So it could be that it comes from a sense that the halakha demands that. It could be. But I suspect that it doesn't. I suspect that it comes from his sensitivity and empathy in this area. In other words, I don't think this is that you would tell the computer, okay, listen, with Agunot, you have to be more makel. No, what you would do, what would be necessary, is that the computer has to learn that women feel pain when they're Agunot, and somehow it has to fit in that that's going to override some sfeikot.
But that's basically what Master's been yawning.
That's what he's telling.
Other he's telling that he versus he's other people, he's able to do that.
He's saying what he's doing is right, and that's what other people, even though they're not feeling it, he's telling them that they should feel it. That's the same thing as us telling a computer to feel.
Right, but
he's telling these.
But if they don't feel it, they don't feel it.
But what he's telling these other people, he's saying you're acting like your computer. You have to inject some feeling into it. So that's the same thing as injecting some feeling into a computer.
You know what? I would agree with you, except for one last thing. And take a look at the last quote that he brings from the Masat Binyamin. This is very interesting. Take a look at this. Mm-hmm. To take a far more limited issue, we are privy to the pain determination of the same Meshiv, that's the Basav Binyamin, who upon losing his vision, okay, he became blind, found himself grappling with the Beit Yosef's conclusion that a blind person could not qualify for an Aliyah. For now in my old age, my eyes have become dim, and according to the Beit Yosef, I should be banished from sharing in the Lord's inheritance, and I should not be counted among those suitable for an Aliyah. Therefore I said, and determined to myself, heaven forfend that I depart from the path of the tree of life and cease grasping its branches. I have loved this law from earliest youth. It has always enjoyed my primacy in my life. Even my old age, I shall not discard it, and I shall walk in its path. Thus, I commenced halachic research to determine why the Beit Yosef has done this to me. Now, it is here, the Posek's own anguish, and with reference to a religious as opposed to a mundane need, but it is nonetheless profoundly human and bears ample witness to the rightful place of sensitivity within the process of halachic decision. Now, one could disagree with the Masat Binyamin. Could say, you have no right to inject your pain in order to change your psak, because one concludes from here that maybe the Masat Binyamin is basically searching for a leniency so that he can get aliyah, right? And a purist would say, what are you doing? You shouldn't be doing that, right? And someone who wasn't the Masat Binyamin wouldn't do that. The only reason the Masat Binyamin is doing it, it would seem, is because he's blind.
He can be empathic.
Which is to say, two things. Number one, that the experience of the posek's life impacts on his psak, and that's okay. That's a huge idea, which may not be replicable, maybe, maybe not. And the second thing, what was the second thing that it says? I'm trying to remember. The second thing is that, you know what? It's okay for the, and this is really where things get complicated. It's okay for the Masad Binyamin to come to the conclusion eventually that he, as a blind person, can get an aliyah, and still also say that the Beit Yosef disagrees, and most poskim disagree, and they come to a different conclusion. And we have to be able to carry both of those in our heads. And some people will follow the Masad Binyamin, and some people will follow the Beit Yosef. And there's and that's the dynamic of halacha. Now, with a computer, we would presume that it's going to only come to one conclusion. If you take two computers that are programmed the same way, right? You would have expected that they would come to the same conclusion. The truth is, but with deep mind, they may not.
It depends on who programs it.
Well, in these cases, with deep mind, he ends up programming himself. So it could be that even he could come to two different conclusions. But that would also be weird. It would be weird in a different way. But I think there's a lot of meat over here for us to think about, because what Rav Lichtenstein is saying is that what we expect is that the posek will inject his humanity, his sensitivity, his own personal experience, and also at the same time know that not every posek is going to come to the same conclusion.
Does Rabbi Lichtenstein agree with this? I think he does.
I absolutely think he does. Yes.
He's not talking about computer. He's not really talking about a computer here.
His subject is not artificial intelligence. His subject is, how do we approach psak? His point is that we don't approach psak as understanding as purely calculated, pure math, you know, logic.
So what I see is, between the Masad Binyamin, he's attacking the line of thought, which
is basically which you see often, like in, I guess, certain lines of Shuvahs, where they have a question. Even though you have an answer, you have a question, you have an answer, you have a question, answer. Because you have a question, even though you have enough backing for all of these answers, and you can answer every single question, the fact that you had a question is enough to say it's awesome. As opposed to other people, when it comes to psak, if they have a question, they have an answer, they'll say it's mutter because I have all of these answers, therefore it's okay. That's what I see.
I didn't totally follow.
For instance, is Hetem Chira.
Okay.
All of the questions which people have against Hetem Chira, Rav Malavad has answers for them. All of these are Rav Lichtenstein, they have answers for them. The people who are machmir say, "Oh, we have a question."
Okay.
So they say, "I have a question. You may have an answer, but I still have a question. Therefore, I'm machmir." That is what, as opposed to, what is the Masad Binyamin is really his focus.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that Rav Lichtenstein is saying we shouldn't be machmir ever. I don't think he's saying that each posek has their own.
You shouldn't always. You shouldn't be trying.
Nobody thinks that we should always be machmir.
No, but I'm saying, as the Masad Binyamin specifically, about refusing to rule on halachic matters.
He was talking about agunot,
and they want to come a clear and unequivocal ruling.
Right? Why? Why? He said because they're afraid of being wrong. So Rav Masad Binyamin says, yes, I'm also afraid of being wrong, but with Agunot, we have to be willing to be wrong because we have to free them. That's what the Masad Binyamin is saying. Perhaps because he had a little bit more experience with Agunot than other people did. It's very easy from across the world to say, no, she can't remarry. But if it's in your community, then you're going to end up perhaps taking a different approach. And Rav Lichtenstein says, that's a very unobjective, very subjective way of psak, and that's okay.
You know what? You're injecting something political into this as well. It's politics. If I am very rigid on the issue of agunot, I might not become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv next year, or people will not be coming to me with questions about halacha. So I have to be a little more lenient, a little more machmer, because it's convenient for me as well.
Yeah, we don't see that in here, though. That's not what the Masad Binyamin is saying.
That's one of the human elements, isn't it?
You're right. There is going to be human elements of politics. That's unfortunate. That definitely, and Yeah, and sometimes it's understandable. You know, sometimes a rabbi will paskin something, you know, unfortunately, maybe because he knows that if he paskins otherwise, then his followers will stop following him. That happens. It happens. That's unfortunate. And it should always be understood that that's why he did it, so that in later generations they know to reverse that when time comes. But, okay, so that's where we take references that far.
The point you want to bring from here is that any computer is that you need emotional intelligence as well.
I think we're... But it's more than emotional intelligence at the end. And that's why I loved the last example, because it was also personal experience. And it was also an acknowledgement, I think it's an important acknowledgement, if the fact is that there can be multiple correct answers, then it kind of tears down the whole idea of objective halakha, which, by the way, he didn't invent. The Ramban in his Melchamos Hashem, we'll quote a different Ramban now, but the Ramban is in Melchamos Hashem, so he points out, you know, how is it that the Rif writes a Sefer, right, and then the Balam Or writes a Sefer and all he does is disagree with the Rif. And then I write a Sefer, and all I do is disagree with the Balam Or and defend him from the Rif. Is it really, how could it be that I always agree with the Rif? Why do I always agree with the Rif and just disagree with the Balam Or? You know, and why are there any arguments at all? So he says, the fact is that the answer is because there is no one truth. There is no one absolute objective answer. There are different viewpoints and different approaches, and all we're trying to do is flesh them all out. Sometimes we have more affiliation to one or the other, but there's a very contrariness is at the root of all halachic writing, because there's so much wave. There's the wavelength is so big that you almost, you know, you grab whatever hasn't been taken yet. It's just the way that it is. It's not math. Because it's not math, there's a lot of space, and so we take it up. So we end up disagreeing to a very, very, very great degree. Okay. There's another problem with... So that would be one problem with artificial intelligence doing psak, right? But there's another problem. Well, a challenge, yeah. Another challenge to artificial intelligence doing psak is the following. The Gemara in Ksubas, okay, so I cut it down. I didn't put the whole thing in. The context is that Abaye gave a psak. It was a relatively simple psak. And then Rav Yehuda pointed out to him, but that was wrong. And then he ran after the man he gave the psak to in order to correct himself. And then the following happens. Said Abaye, the statement made by the rabbis, that even a question about the permissibility of eating an egg with a kuta, that's a very simple question, eating an egg with milchik, in a milchik dish, a man shall not decide in a district which is under the jurisdiction of his master. In other words, one rabbi should not paskin, a Talmud should not paskin in the city of his Rebbe. That was a halacha. That you shouldn't be paskining in an area where it's under someone else's jurisdiction, even if it's, you know, kibiyata b'chutcha, b'kutach, it's the simplest question ever. It's like, you know, can you light a fire on Shabbos? Doesn't matter what it is. You shouldn't be answering questions in someone else's jurisdiction. So he says that was not due to the view that this might appear as an act of irreverence. Says this line is not because it's disrespectful to the rabbi, but to the reason that a disciple would have no success in dealing with the matter. Lo istaya milta. He would not be successful. For I, in fact, have learned the tradition of Rabbi Shmuel, and yet I did not get the opportunity of applying. He said, look, I got it wrong. What's he saying? So it's usually understood what he's saying is, istaya milta sounds a lot like siyata d'shmaya. So the classic understanding of this Gemara is that a posek is not enough for him to just have studied. It's not enough for him to just be smart. He needs siyata d'shmaya. He needs help from Shamayim. That a posek, when he paskins, he is interacting with the divine, and he's getting input that way, and so that's going to help him along with his psak. I think the strongest version of this is what the Ramban says in, actually, this week's parasha. Just happens to be. It's this week's parasha. This week's parasha has the pasuk, Lo tasur mikol asher yegidu lecha, yamin usmol. Shall not deviate from their words to the right or to the left. Right? You have to listen to the rabbis. The Ramban writes on that pasuk, he says, what does it mean? So he has a long essay about it, where he says that this is essential to the way that halakha and the Torah process works. We have to respect the rabbis, otherwise everybody's going to go off doing whatever they want. But then he doesn't stop there. And I'll read to you what he says. Hatzorach b'mitzvah hazot gadol mod. The need for this is very great. Ki Torah nitna lanu b'chtav v'yaduahu shalishtavu adeot b'chol advarim hanoladim. Because not everybody will agree on all matters, like we just said. V'nei yarbu ha-machlokot v'taseh ha-torah kama torot. Because it's not binary, or it's not unary, really, there will be all different kinds of opinions. Everybody will come up with a different opinion. V'chatach lanu ha-katuv ha-din sh'nishma le-beitin ha-gadol ha-omed lifnei Hashem b'makom ha-sho yivchar. You should listen to the Beit Din that sits in the Beit HaMikdash. B'kol ma sh'yomru lanu b'perush ha-Torah b'en sh'kibu perushu a'ed mipi a'ed Moshe mipi gura. And it doesn't matter whether their answer comes a'ed mipi a'ed for Moshe Rabbeinu o sh'yomru lefi mashmaot ha-mikra o kavanata, or if they're just trying to explain the meaning of the Pesukim based on their own knowledge. Why? Ki ala da'at sh'lehem unotein lanhem ha-Torah. Because Hashem gives us the Torah on their da'at to follow their opinion. Even if it looks like they're switching the right with the left, because Hashem's spirit is on those who serve his mikdash, and he does not abandon his saints. They will always be protected from making mistakes and from stumbling.
So because the machine isn't completely closed,
right,
there's no...
Right. Because we can safely...
No extra protection.
We can reasonably presume that Hashem does not guide... Well, now that I say it out loud, we can reasonably presume that Hashem does not provide the same guidance to a machine that it would provide to Talmidei Chachamim.
And if it did, that would be... Hashem can't, because that would basically be the same thing as the Baskel.
Meaning if he admitted he's
the computer? Let's say the reverse. The machine doesn't seek the same guidance from Hashem.
Right. In other words, if we assume that the guidance that the Talmid Chacham receives is correspondent to his spiritual stature, to his saintliness, to his Kedusha, to his Chassidut, so then the computer is never going to have that. Now, what happens if the computer programmer is a big tzaddik, is a big chassid, maybe? Let's presume not that way. So this would be another counter-argument for why we would not rely on artificial intelligence for psak, because we cannot believe that it has the same protection from Hashem.
There's two different types of psak. There's sort of psak which needs emotional input, but then there's like psak as... do you say Yalla Biyobo if you started a meal on Rosh Chodesh?
That's Halacha Psuka, you're right. Halacha Psuka, you can look it up in a book.
Right,
it's the same thing as looking up in a book. Maybe artificial intelligence could help. You know, if a Posik said, okay, here's the question, so you get the computer to write out a tshuva, and then you read the tshuva and you decide whether you think it's right or not. You know, that's reasonable.
Or the computer will give me three
I would not be surprised if that happens.
Or the computer will give me three different tshuvas and you say, pick the one you like.
Yeah, I mean, I could do that.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I've looked up questions on the
computer. Of course. Right, but the computer's not giving you the answer. Somebody wrote the answer. But let's say the computer went in, it knows all of Shas and Poskim, it writes you a tshuva, which is what it can do. Now they're writing movie scripts, they're computers that write songs.
Like, if you ask a question...
It can write a psak, why can't it? But the point over here would be that you wouldn't be able to just look at it and say, okay, this is right. You would have to be able to read it, to understand it, to figure out, you know, Talmud Chacham, steeped in Torah, would have to read it and understand whether it's correct or not. Now, this is the Ramban's view. You know, certainly there are other views that say that that's not the way that halacha works. That halacha is completely human endeavor. In which case, maybe we wouldn't say the same thing. But it's definitely according to the Ramban.
There's no siyach b'shmaya aspect.
Yeah, why not?
I don't know. Within like the mainstream.
Like, yeah,
of,
why not?
Of all the arguments,
Hashem said,
like,
"Study the Torah."
That's always been the way that.
Yeah, I know.
So
yeah,
I'm unaware.
It's a quasi mystical way of looking at it. It's definitely.
Is there another? Is there a accepted means?
I don't know. I don't think I'm going to find someone who says Hashem never helps with halacha. No, I don't think I'm going to find that. Let's take the Lo B'Shamayim case, right? So what happened? So Rabbi Lazar. Right, says the Tanur is, I never remember whether it's Tanur or Tame, and Rabbi Yeshua and the Chacham disagree, and then the Baskel comes out and says Rabbi Lazar is right. Right? Now, there are different ways of understanding Rabbi Lazar is right. I'm partial to the Maral in that the Maharal says that the Bas Kol didn't say Rabbi Elazar was right in this case. The Bas Kol didn't say Rabbi Elazar was right in this case. It said Rabbi Elazar is, the halacha is always like Rabbi Elazar. That's what the Bas Kol actually says. It says the halacha is always like Rabbi Elazar, which is very different from saying Rabbi Elazar is right about this. It's different. It's different because the way Maharal says it is that it's a value judgment about Rabbi Elazar. It's like saying, you know, it's like saying my wife is always right. That doesn't mean my wife is always actually factually right. It just means we act like my wife is right all the time.
Does the
Maharal say that's an obvious distinction, right? The customer is always right. No, he's not. But that's definitely a good policy.
I don't know if that's analogous. Does the Maharal say Rabbi Elazar is always right? Or does he say Rabbi Elazar is generally right?
No,
does
so the Gemara just says, Halacha k'Rabbi Elazar b'kol davar, something like that.
And you quote the Maharal.
Yeah, so the Maharal points out, he says, notice that it doesn't say that Rabbi Elazar is right here. It just says the Halacha is always like Rabbi Elazar, which is to say that Hashem likes Rabbi Elazar.
Okay.
That's how the Maharal understands the Gemara. And then what Rabbi Yeshua's response is, we don't care who Hashem likes. We don't care. We came to a conclusion, and the Halacha is like the majority. That's just the way to read the Gemara. Now, others may not read it that way, and if you don't read it that way, right? If you read it just the simplest way, and then it's saying that Rabbi Elazar is right, then how could they disagree? Unless the whole thing was given over to human hands, and whatever conclusion we come up with, that's the conclusion. Right? What's the Ramban assuming over here, by the way? The most important thing that Ramban says over here is probably the most wrong thing that he says, which is that he says, and therefore, lo olam nishmer min ha-taut u min ha-michshol. This is one of the most powder keg Rambans, and he has an issue because it's against the mitzvah in the Torah, right? We have something called the Par Ha'alam Davar, which is the korban that is brought when the Beit Din makes a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
When it says this is chaylev and it wasn't chaylev, or this wasn't chaylev and it was chaylev. There's an entire masechet where the whole first parak of Horios is about this. What happens when the Beit Din makes a mistake? And the Ramban struggles mightily. He has to interpret the Gemara, and many point out, how does the Ramban deal with this? How does the Ramban deal with, and you know, Shechter is on the table saying this, the Ramban is not really correct. It's not correct in the sense that they're not always correct, factually. And, you know, there are cases where you can determine the fact. They say, Beit Din say this stuff is chaylev, and it's really not, or vice versa. And then we determine afterwards, look at it, it's not chaylev. Right? That can happen. The fact that can happen means that there's something else going on over here. It puts more of the human stamp on it.
Good.
So I think we're going to stop there tonight because it's late.
Yeah, very good.
There's more to say even in this topic, so we'll continue with it next time. We'll even we'll see a. I forgot to bring the computer tonight, so maybe next time I'll bring it. We'll see a clip from The Matrix. That should make. I actually have a few clips for this one. It's going to be fun.
Very cool.
For this whole show. Anyways. To be continued, this discussion.
Can you see this, Rabbi?
Rabbi, did you see this? 45 minutes.